Let's get ready to suck up!
I think our strength is it starts up front with that offensive line, and that's our run game, and that's protecting the quarterback. With those two things, I think we'll go from there. Definitely, our offense starts with the run game, and we build from there.
Cheers, Bears fans! This is Bears Barroom Radio. I am Aldo Gandia, and that was Bears starting quarterback Mike Glennon identifying the team's biggest strength. We're going to tackle Glennon's performance in camp after five practices, Trubisky's troubles, touch on the tight ends, worry about Kevin White, get to some of your questions that you submitted over Twitter on our account at Bears Barroom, and more, including offending various parts of our audience, as we always do.
Lick it.
We engage in juvenile humor intended for mature audiences. The Barflies are, of course, Bears Are Alive chief analyst Phil Atoshin, Bears Barroom lead analyst Shane Marsaw, and the new host of the daily podcast Locked On Bears, Lauren Cox. Look for Locked On Bears on iTunes and Audio Boom. It's an excellent addition to your audio cupboard of Bears news. Gentlemen, welcome. And I'm not sure that if you guys noticed that I'm using the Selena Gomez instrumental track of her hit song, Bad Liar. So I ask you, Mr. Marsaw, is Mike Glennon a bad liar, or is he telling the truth when he says the Bears' strength on offense begins up front? The reason I ask is because neither Kyle Long or Josh Sitton has practiced yet, and Eric Kush has been nursing a minor injury. Bad liar or what?
I got to give Glennon some props here. I think he's actually telling the truth. I don't think when he's talking about that, and I don't think he's talking about 5 days into camp. I think he's kind of projecting forward to hopefully what our offensive line looks like versus Atlanta. So I think, you know, if the offensive line is healthy, I think it's pretty obvious that that is the strength of the Bears' offense, especially on the interior. So, you know, immediately right now with Sitton being a new father and being away and Kyle Long still dealing with his ankle injury, of course, it's not a strength right now. But I don't think that really that's what he was referring to. I think he's kind of projecting forward and, you know, when all cylinders are firing and everybody's in there, I think it's unquestionably the strength of this offense.
Can I jump in right away on this offensive line, and particularly Josh Sitton? Because I know I talked to you guys a little bit about this off air, but if Josh Sitton's child was just born this past weekend, end of July, doing math here, 9 months ago when he conceived the child would have been at the very end of October when Josh Sitton was injured and out with, I believe it was an ankle injury off the top of my head. So is this guy not focusing 100% on his rehab and instead focusing on getting busy with Mrs. Sitton? I mean, what's the deal here? Wait, was this guy not in it for the long haul in the regular season?
I got to see a picture of Mrs. Sitton before I'm going to answer anything.
To Google.
I think she looks like David Bakhtiari.
Oh, jeez.
No, I'm just kidding, Josh. Just a joke. I know you're listening.
Listen, are you not a man? That's our focus all the time, Lauren. Come on. I injured ankle. We're making up a different way to make that happen, Lauren.
Yeah, I found a picture on Google.
She's there. On top, or
it's Josh Sitton. So is he sitting on, or is she sitting on? You know what I mean?
I think she's sitting on, sir. He's a big guy.
Well, I got to tell you, I want to spend some time here talking about Mike Glennon because he's had a pretty decent first five practices for the Bears, and I listened to his 45-minute interview on, I think it's called Bears Access. You can find it on ChicagoBears.com. He was interviewed by Zach Sadman, and who was it? Tom Thayer. And Glennon really impressed me with a lot of what he had to say about being a quarterback and how he has developed over the years. Let me play you a portion of that, just a quick soundbite, where he talks about what he was looking for when he was deciding where to go during free agency.
I'm a quarterback that needs to sit in the pocket and make plays and have a good run game. And when I was looking at, you know, potential teams, the Bears had that. They have a great offensive line and a great running game. So to me, it just all made sense to come to Chicago, one of the top markets in the country with such tradition. I just felt like it was, you know, the right team for me to go to, and I'm just glad it worked out.
Phil, you got to give the guy credit. He knows his limitations. He knows what his strengths are, and he picked a team that is suitable for his talents, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, he's talking fits, and he's recognizing right now what Dahl Loggins is wanting. And if you have a strong running game and an improved defense, what you're looking at on paper there, the Chicago Bears obviously have a defense that, if they stay healthy, they're going to see a lot of improvement. As far as the quarterback is concerned, you know, if that offensive line comes back healthy, and there's a lot of ifs there, I think Sitton's going to be fine. Long, you got to be happy with seeing him in full pads now going out through walkthroughs. So the confidence seems to be building in there. And then are we going to get the right tackle position the end of the season, Bobby Massey, or are we going to get the beginning of the year, Bobby Massey, you know? And Charles Leno is working off a contract year, so I think he's coming in here motivated. And obviously, everyone knows how I feel about the center. I think he's arguably maybe the best in football. That's how high I think of this football player. This kid is special. So he's right, you know. He's got an offensive line, and you have one of the best backs, if not the best back in football. He's going to be interesting to watch, but I think that bodes well for Glennon, because if Glennon could come in here and block out the noise and attack the game plan and know the playbook and hold those receivers accountable, then he can have success, and then you're going to be looking at a year where he can stand off the rookie and really, you know, showcase what you need here, and that's consistency at the quarterback position.
As time goes on here, I'm becoming more and more excited about seeing Glennon as the starting quarterback for the Bears. I really do believe he's got a chance to impress people. And I've said this before on this show, the key thing is whether he can convert first downs and moving the ball up and down the field into touchdowns, something that we did not see from Brian Hoyer, despite the fact that he had four consecutive games of 300-plus passing yards. And one of the things that excites me about Glennon is his experience in the league. This is what he talked about, what he's learned as a professional football quarterback with the Tampa Bay Bucs.
I think mentally is the biggest difference, just taking strides of learning defenses better, knowing offense better, protections. I mean, just everything. I've just, you know, grown a lot mentally. I mean, it's like I talked about earlier, I did have a good foundation, but there's still a lot to learn. And just going against an NFL defense every day, I mean, even though I was running a scout team, I'm still going against real NFL players, you know, starter NFL players. And the more reps you get, just the more comfortable you get.
Shane, listening to Glennon on this show, All Access, you can catch it on ChicagoBears.com, it convinces me that this guy really is in a position to utilize the experiences that he's had as an NFL quarterback and a backup quarterback and transform himself into a quality starting quarterback. It also convinces me that Mitchell Trubisky has a wonderful opportunity to learn the game off the bench and go through what Glennon has gone through, particularly his last 2 years, and develop at a pace that's conducive to him. What do you think?
No, I agree. I think in a perfect world, that's, you know, exactly what Ryan Pace and the Chicago Bears want to happen, and I think probably all Bears fans should really hope that happens, that Mike Glennon comes in and shows that he's more than capable, and the Bears can win games while you have the, you know, potential franchise leader waiting in the wings, you know, as his understudy, because it's only going to be a benefit to the Bears in this big 2018 offseason coming up. You know, if they could potentially move Glennon for draft picks with a controllable, you know, a very easily controllable contract. So, but no, I totally agree with what you said, Aldo. It was nice to listen to Mike Glennon in that interview, because you could hear the veteran savvy come through. And, you know, it's just nice to have that for the first time in, you know, as long as I can remember. The Bears have a young signal caller that still has some upside with, you know, the franchise caliber young, you know, high draft pick waiting in the wings. I mean, how long have we really all been waiting for that? You know, just to, they're covering their bases. But one thing I do want to throw out there about Glennon, he didn't come here for the money. He didn't come here for the starting job. You know, like Eric Lambert said, we play the Bucks in week two, so that was a given that he was going to be coming to Chicago just because of the schedule. So
the only reason.
Just want to throw that out there.
I need to start collecting all of these tweets and opinions that just don't make any fucking sense. But go ahead, Shane.
But no, it's going to be a lot of fun to watch, because Mike Glennon is really playing for his, you know, life as a potential starting quarterback, and it's all really going to hinge on these first few games, because other than the three, you know, the fumbled three out of five fumbled snaps that everybody was overreacting to with Trubisky and you know, things like that, it really sounds like, I believe Lauren even said it on Locked On Bears, that there really hasn't been a huge difference. There hasn't been that eye-opening moment where you say, wow, there's a clearly defined difference where Mike Glennon is way ahead of Trubisky in this battle so far, and really Trubisky is still the number three. But it's going to be a fun thing to watch, and I think really all Bears fans, yes, we all want to see Trubisky, but for the betterment of the franchise, I think we should all be rooting for Mike Glennon to go out there and perform, because it's only going to pay off for the Bears in the future.
Yeah, and here's another thing that Glennon said that really impressed me, and it has to do with his leadership skills.
I know what I'm looking for in guys on certain plays, and I know when they're right and I know when they're wrong, and I feel like I can, you know, either offer advice of how to fix that, or, you know, maybe jump on them a little bit. You know, there's a time and a place for that too. So
that is the biggest difference between him and Mitch Trubisky right now. While Mitch Trubisky is busy learning basics about being an NFL quarterback, taking the snap and making reads and so forth, Glennon has passed that eons ago and is now focused on coaching up his receivers, his tight ends, and helping his offensive linemen and so forth. Wouldn't you agree with that, Lauren? And also, I know you and Phil did a lot of tape study on Glennon. Can you talk a little bit about what you learned about his footwork when you looked at that tape study of Mike Glennon?
You know, as encouraging as it is to hear and see Mike Glennon grow as a leader on this team, I don't want to say that Mitch Trubisky couldn't do that. And I feel like from what we've heard about his 1 year as a starter at Carolina or North Carolina, he certainly has leadership qualities. And, you know, Ryan Pace has spoken effusively about the man he is off the field and the way he works hard. And I do think that when Trubisky is given the opportunity, and even if he was their number one quarterback and they were fully behind him and didn't have Mike Glennon, I think we would start to see similar things come out about him. I don't necessarily know how different. I mean, obviously Mike Glennon has, like you said, he's not trying to learn the basics, but I don't know how many of the basics Mitch Trubisky, or how much that is really occupying Mitch Trubisky's time in terms of impacting his ability to be a leader on this team if he were given the opportunity to do so. But clearly the roles have been defined here very strictly by the team as far as who is going to lead whom and who is the backup and who is the starter. So, you know, it's not a – I'm not trying to say that Trubisky should be or is equally in a position to be a leader, but I do think that if he had that role given to him, everything we've heard about Mitch Trubisky is that he could be the same type of leader Mike Glennon is. But as far as Glennon, the quarterback, I don't think footwork has necessarily been a huge issue for him. I mean, part of it is more of the feel of the pocket and knowing when and where to get out. I mean, he's not known as an athletic guy, but he is, when he does have a lane to escape the pocket, he does know how to take it. But sometimes he has a bad feel for when and where he can get out of the pocket. Like, he'll feel the pressure, but he won't be perfectly certain where it is, and he can get a little bit caught up and maybe bump into his own offensive lineman as he's trying to escape and ultimately knock himself off balance and lose any potential getaway momentum that he had. But in terms of, you know, taking the ball from under center and dropping back and surveying the field, I thought his footwork was fine. I mean, it's not – I mean, I'm sure he's always got room for improvement in that sense. I mean, even – I think even Tom Brady can improve his footwork. Every quarterback is trying to improve that. And especially when he gets under pressure, I think you want to see every quarterback. That's where it always goes. But as far as a base level of expectations of a quarterback who's been in the NFL for, what is it now, four seasons of Mike Glennon, not even though he hasn't played in all four, just being in four training camps and four off seasons, I think he's right at about the level that he needs to be at, and he can always have room for improvement.
Yeah, it was Zach Sayman on WSCR Radio who reminded me that Bill Walsh, the greatest offensive mind in football history, in my opinion, once said that when he scouts a quarterback, the first thing that he looks at is not the strength of his arm or anything else. He's looking at footwork. He's looking at that how the quarterback moves his feet around in the pocket, is able to do the things like Aaron Rodgers does so beautifully, and buys time, can feel the rush and move his feet. Phil, when you looked at Mike Glennon's tape, can you expound on what Lauren was just saying regarding Glennon's footwork?
Well, I mean, I think Lauren did chapter and verse in regards to the quarterback, Glennon.
Amen.
I mean, to me, you see a sneaky athlete. I mean, some of the things that we saw, granted, this was from his rookie season on the tape, so were surprising to me. As an evaluator, I look at, can you mentally handle the position? And let's think about this. First, there's the verbiage and the understanding of the whole playbook. So now, once you grasp that, that's only one piece of the puzzle. You're talking about footwork, as the great Bill Walsh said. That's in the scouting of the athleticism. He's improved that, you would hope, because he was more of a plodding type of drop-back passer in regards to his footwork and sneaky athletic. Now, the second part of this process is he has to read coverages. Now he gets to the line, sees the play, isn't the right play. Can he check you out of that play? Or can every play beat a certain defense, even though you would like to have it against a different coverage? If that's what your offensive coordinator has done for his quarterback, now he now has the only responsibility is to recognize the coverage and understand where the beater is. And that's the person that's going to be open versus a specific defensive coverage and defensive system, or if they're in the 4-3 and they're giving you a bare front, you know, can he understand that he might have to run away from that outside backer that's on the line of scrimmage? Those things are the things that'll be the obstacles for a younger quarterback. As far as leadership is concerned, I think person's energy and personality, as well as their performance, leads to leadership. So I know I'm throwing a bunch at you, but it's like there is a starting line for these two players. This kid was drafted in the first round in Mitchell Trubisky to be the future of the Bears. Otherwise, if Glennon was a sure thing, in any GM's mind, it wouldn't be what we thought it would be, a quarterback in round one at that high. So now, you know, everyone's talking a certain way about what's right, what's wrong. You know, the coaches are going to know. That's who's got to know, because I don't think there's any prerequisite, so to speak, for a quarterback to come into the league a la Russell Wilson and go and be successful. And then you could point out five other quarterbacks that were thrown in there that weren't successful. It's the individual with the coaches working and understanding their roles and assignments, as well as the talents surrounding him. I mean, you look at last year, Aldo, your offensive coordinator could have helped a Matthew Barkley not throw four red zone picks as he did against the Vikings, or three red zone picks as he did against the Vikings, by running the football and making simple down and distance. So a lot of times performance gets plastered on the newspaper. The elite performers, like you said, Aaron Rodgers, a Tom Brady, are going to take that kind of credit. But with Glennon, I see an average quarterback. With Trubisky, I saw a first-round quarterback. So when I see the two of them and I look at the athletic traits that you want, footwork and all of that, then Trubisky's going to win if you're playing the Bill Walsh card, because that kid's a superior athlete to a Mike Glennon. Now, Glennon has the time and experience wrapped up behind him. So to me, this would have been an open competition, and that's how I would have ran with it. We signed you, yep, but we got a high first round pick and we had a high grade on this kid. Let's see what you both can do. And then Sanchez is your emergency in case anything goes wrong or there's a problem. But he's not taking any reps in practice. The two of them are battling and dueling it out, ultimately getting and squeezing the most out of Mike Glennon and the most out of the young buck. And if the young buck isn't ready, then he's sitting his ass on the bench and learning just the way, you know, they're setting it up. But at least you got that squeeze play in there. At least you got that competition to see if they could rise to the top and handle the media and handle the situation of not being named the starter. What kind of person is that? Are you going to just cower and quit? Or are you going to keep battling? Those kind of answers you could use in these simulations to get the most out of both guys. And that would have been the best thing for the Bears in my mind. Not to say that maybe privately in-house they're not doing that. When I look at Mike Glennon, I think there's limitations to what he could do, and ultimately the offensive coordinator is going to rule the day with him because of his lack of athleticism.
Lauren, you were at camp Sunday. We've read the news reports about Trubisky's troubles in camp. What did you see Sunday, which was his fourth practice with the Bears since training camp opened? What did you see in the young quarterback?
Well, I saw a guy that successfully took every snap from under center without fumbling it. So I'm glad. On Sunday, I didn't see a single botched snap from under center. Although they did plenty of shotgun with him, but I meant to look up before the show. I had forgotten that I was going to check this just to know what percentage of the time the Bears' offense was in shotgun last year. Because I know there's been a lot of talk, and I know I'm getting away from the question at hand here, but
it's okay.
You know, the Bears aren't really so much, at least last year they weren't, and especially under Adam Gase before that, they're not as much of a, you know, traditional under center offense. They do more of the spread concepts. Scrolling down right now for the shotgun, they had 607 plays in shotgun and 360 under center, so a good two-thirds of their plays are in shotgun anyway. So, you know, and of course, from a passing and rushing split, 453 passes in shotgun to 106 passes under center. So it's very clear that, you know, when they're throwing the ball, they're in shotgun. So that's where Mitch Trubisky is going to work out of the majority of the time. So it's not as though the snap thing is all that much of a concern. And even the footwork under center is still it's still something that he needs to learn and needs to master as an NFL quarterback. But in terms of getting ready if he needed to play in Dowell Loggins' offense this year. The whole under center thing isn't that big of a deal, and it's something that he'll pick up pretty darn quickly. It's, I don't know if I've ever heard of a quarterback prospect struggling to pick that up, and then that being the only issue that they have. If your quarterback can't pick up the under center thing, they're not picking up the rest of how to play quarterback. But if Mitch Trubisky can get everything else figured out, this is going to be the least of his concerns in, as far as his development moving forward. But at training camp, you saw a guy, I don't know, he looked a lot like he did in college, which is the least surprising thing ever. But, you know, he made some nice plays with his legs and could fire the ball downfield and hit some nice windows. But there are other times, too, where, you know, you'd like to see him either make a quicker decision with the ball. I mean, he knows that, and then maybe that's just because it's practice and he knows he can't get sacked. So, you know, he's looking around the field and trying to find the play, but then, you know, extends it just looking for the best possible time to throw the ball. But ultimately maybe waits too long and then has to just throw it away or try and force in a difficult pass. And he did force in some difficult passes successfully. I think he threw an interception at one point, but it wasn't all that horrible of a play. I don't remember the specific details, but I want to say it was a contested throw, you know, threw it to a guy and the defensive back went up for it with him and ultimately came down with it. So, you know, he's making good throws. He's making good decisions with the ball and seems to be reading the defense well enough. But, it's not anything close to a real football practice and real situation for him. And I'm more curious to see how he handles adversity more than anything else, because we know, especially when a guy is taken that high in the draft, but just what we've seen on tape, that when he can handle all of the easy quarterback situations, you know, when he has a clean pocket to throw to and it's, you know, it's quick slants or any kind of easy play for quarterback, he's going to take those and run with them, you know, a walk in the park. But I want to see what he does when he has to hold on to the ball a little bit longer, when maybe he doesn't have receivers separating, and what happens when, you know, Bobby Massey gets beat to the inside and Mitch Trubisky has to try and break free from the pocket where all the defenders are running after him a little bit faster, all the corners are covering receivers a little bit tighter, and all the linebackers are in a slightly better position than they were when he was in college. To me, that's going to be where we can start to actually evaluate where Mitch Trubisky's at in his development, because for now I think they're just trying to get him, you know, used to hearing the play call names and getting that out to his teammates, used to getting in the huddle with these guys and used to getting under center, used to just every single aspect of Dowell Loggins' offense before they try and expand and more push what he's capable of as a quarterback. I think, although, like you mentioned, the baseline, learning how to play NFL quarterback in this team, that's where they're at mostly with him right now, and they're not testing him or pushing him to, at least you know, in the practices that are open to public, pushing him to try a lot of new things and really grow, at least at this point in training camp.
Lauren, can you do me a favor while I ask Shane a question here and get his response? Can you look at yards per carry for Jordan Howard out of the shotgun position and out of under center, just to see if there's a big difference in his productivity under those two different schemes, so to speak? And then I can
tell you for the whole team. I don't have it broken down by running back, but just as an offense, so the split was 133 runs from shotgun to 247 from under center. So what is that, like 60-40-ish? Mm-hmm. In shotgun, they averaged 5.9 yards per carry. Under center, 3.9.
Wow, that's amazing.
But all 10 of their rushing touchdowns came under center, because they didn't have a rushing touchdown longer than like 12 yards last year, 16 yards last year. So it was all red zone touchdowns for Jordan Howard under center.
Interesting.
Aldo, real quick coaching point. Mm-hmm. Taking a snap under center is one of the easiest things to coach. It's very elementary. It's just about getting used to it. It's like driving a stick shift car. At first, it seems like the hardest thing because you hadn't done it before. But once you get it, it becomes second nature. That's why it's not even a concern whatsoever. I mean, obviously, it is in a reps, counting, pressure cooker practice. When you get in the games, of course, it becomes important. You look at Rex Grossman in the Super Bowl, one of the most famous muff snaps ever. It could have probably cost the Chicago Bears a Super Bowl, a second Super Bowl. It obviously carries huge importance, but again, it's like what I said. Very easy to coach up. There's two ways to take a snap. You can either take it in a diamond or pyramid form where you put one hand under center and one hand cupping, almost like a Pac-Man. And the center will turn the ball as he's snapping it so you can get the laces on that top hand. The other way to do it is two hands up and you brace thumbs. Now the center's snapping it straight up, which a lot of NFL quarterbacks are going to prefer because there's less work and less thinking for the center and the quarterback at the same time, because when it hits his hands, he's going to transition it to his thumb so he can grasp the laces. So however the quarterback feels most comfortable as a coach, you are going to let that player do, and the center is going to adjust. And that's why I don't think it's much to do about nothing. It's just a young kid in his first NFL practice taking a few missed snaps with different centers doing different things. You don't even know yet. So just wanted to put that out there. It's become such a big deal that it's ridiculous in my mind.
Very good. Okay, let me go to Shane here. I want to talk about Kevin White. He's been in the news lately, and it appears that White is battling some confidence issues. Wide receiver coach Zach Azani. Did I mispronounce that, guys? Azani?
Azani. No, run with it. No, it's good. You got it.
It finally hit a single.
He was quoted in the Chicago Tribune as saying, "I can't let Kevin White read the papers and listen to the media. I just can't, because there is going to be some negative stuff in there, and that gets to his head, and he can't let that happen. He has to be positive, and we've got to go in our bunker all the time and tell him how great he is, because he is." Shane, what, I know you were tweeting about this earlier, does that ring any alarms for you when you hear a wide receivers coach talking about a draft pick who was the seventh overall pick of the 2014 draft?
Yeah, you know, initially it did. I think everybody at this point is, you know, upset. You got the seventh pick in the draft. You don't get to see him at all the first year. And then year two, it looks like he's, you know, kind of forced in there and doesn't really show a hell of a lot, and then goes out after four games and then, you know, essentially misses his whole second season. But honestly, to this point, and I know Phil probably isn't going to agree with me on this, it's just, I think there's going to be a confidence issue with,
do we lose Shane? In that,
hey, Shane, can you hear us?
Circumstance.
Poor guy hasn't talked in a half hour and the fucking signal goes away. Shane, are you with us?
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
All right. Not any better yet.
It's still a little
keep
garbled.
Losing you. I just think that if you kowtow to any player based on drafting and draftable status wherever they were, then you set yourself up in a locker room full of other men who are battling every day to play this great game. And there becomes animosity. And when you create that, then you also get sides drawn where they're going to say, yo, this fucking kid is a pussy. And that's what... Hello?
Shane?
And that's where I think that this line should be drawn, because you're setting this kid. I mean, if he's not motivated and he's worried about what people are saying, then you drafted the wrong guy. Because ultimately, your competitive nature of what you've done since you were a young boy should be at its all-time high. I don't think Odell Beckham is worrying about what anybody's saying about him, because when the ball game and the lights are on, that young man came ready to play, and that's what you drafted Kevin White to be. So with all this being said, kind of a poke or peek behind the curtain of what's going on in his mind they're alluding to, I just think it gave opponents an easy target, and I think it causes separation. This football player, if he doesn't know that he needs to step up, then I don't know what to tell him. But if he's feeling too much pressure, I think that's the dumbest, stupidest thing I've ever seen. It really makes, you know, the situation dire in my eyes, that this kid is going to be forced out there and do what they did again. Go ahead, Lauren.
And what's going to happen when he's out on the field and say he drops a pass, and say they're playing the Denver Broncos week one, he drops a pass, and Aqib Talib at the next play gets right up to the line of scrimmage and says, "Oh, Kevin White, you're a bust. You're a bust. You're dropping passes out here, boy. You're going to come drop another pass. You're going to get beat by me. I'm going to beat your ass on the football field." You know, corner, you know, exactly. If they know he has a confidence issue, if the wide receivers coach publicly says, "We have to remind this kid how good he is," you know, the veteran cornerbacks that like to talk a little bit. I know they play the Bengals, and Adam Pac-Man Jones will talk a little bit. I don't know off the top of my head who all the most talkative corners are, but you know that's going to keep showing up on the field, and they're going to get try and get right in his head. And is Kevin White mentally strong enough to really block that out and say, "Ah, nah, you know, I know he's just messing with me"? Or if he goes 3, 4, 5 plays in a row without getting free on his coverage and can't get the ball targeted, or maybe he gets targeted but it's overthrown because he's too well covered, is that going to wear on him on a play-to-play and game-to-game basis? If he goes a couple games with, you know, one catch a game for 3 weeks, is he going to go into that fourth game feeling, "Oh, woe is me, I'm not a good wide receiver and need that pickup"? I mean, that's where I'm concerned with him, is just long-term. Mm-hmm. How, is this an issue for a one-time situation where, you know, he's dealing with these exceptional injuries, so I understand that it's hard for him to get over this. And is he going to get over that and then be fine? Or is this going to be something that is a recurring confidence issue for the rest of his career?
And I think that's the key issue. I think the reason his confidence is low right now is because he doesn't know whether his leg is going to hold up. 2 seasons in a row, he has had season-ending injuries. And I think that's what is bugging him right now, is can I play at the same level I did at college before these injuries, with that same swagger, with that same hard cuts, with that turbo explosion? Can he do it? And I think that's what's holding him back, is just his concern regarding that. I think Shane is back online. Shane, are you there?
I'm back.
Damn,
there he
brother.
Is.
We got to tell you, man, we just covered that issue, and the show is over.
I couldn't hear anything that was said, but I disagree with everything Phil just said.
Well, we talked about Kevin White, and I want to get your point on this before we move on to our next topic. But what are your thoughts about Kevin White and the confidence issues that he's facing?
I think it's pretty obvious at this point. I mean, when the wide receiver coach is coming out and saying there's some confidence issues, I think that's probably expected at this point when you're talking about essentially missing your first 2 years and you're a new GM's, you know, number 7 overall draft pick, first draft pick, and miss your rookie campaign, and then 4 games in, you're not really showing everything that you believe you're capable of in year 2, and then you get rolled up on and you go out again. To me, I really thought the wide receiver coach was, you know, with him going public, it was just kind of putting pressure on Kevin White, kind of calling him out a little bit and saying, "Listen, you can't let all this outside noise affect what you're doing." And, you know, to me too, I think I brought up with you guys a little bit earlier today, I kind of look at it, maybe this plays into why Alshon wasn't re-signed, and this is Ryan Pace's way of saying, "Listen, you're either gonna shit or get off the pot. At this point, we're gonna put you out there, and you're gonna sink or swim." To me, this is all on Kevin White. I don't, probably Phil doesn't agree with me here with the I don't think it's a coddling issue. It's just, to me, it's all, he's got to get out there and he's got to be healthy and he's got to play. Because when it comes to confidence, he can go out there and have one big game and it can change, you know, it can create a tidal wave the other way. And, you know, it, and he can and start playing like the number, the seventh overall pick. But at this point in camp, we're not really going to know a whole heck of a lot. And I don't think until these games, you know, until the bullets start flying for real. And it's, you know, he's just got to get out there and he's got to prove it.
Al, the quick, I want to make a point here. Jump on in. Kevin White, to Shane's point. I'm going to agree somewhat with Shane. I think these people at practice tweeting out, looking for wow plays is great. Dumb. You know, that is the dumbest thing. This is practice. You know, they're not out there to wow you. They're trying to work their craft and the playbook at the same time and preparing for their next scrimmage. So this ultimately is not about wow plays. This is about confidence. This is a mental sport as well as a collision sport. So you have to be mentally prepared. I don't think many people understand how thick and massive these playbooks are and responsibilities based on what it is you need to learn prior to even stepping out there and then to ultimately tap into that playbook and put it into processing on the football field as it's happening. To correlate those two things at once, it really takes a lot of special person. And if you're thinking too much and you're not going full speed and you've dropped the ball, as Lauren said, how your psyche is with all this pressure, he just has to go out and play football like he did as a young kid. If it's not fun for people, I've seen people with more talent than players that have, you know, a Devin Hester. I've witnessed kids that have had talent like that and ultimately just can't get the mental processing of a playbook or the mental process of the game, the hitting and the contact. And the disappointment that they dropped the football and they've quit. They can't do it. They have all the talent in the world, but they don't have that ability to overcome. And that is the huge thing here. We can't be charting his wow plays in practice. When the lights come on, we're going to know about Mike Glennon. We're going to know about Kevin White. And we're going to know about all of these players. Because that's where it matters most. In the scrimmage, on the football field.
That leaves.
You know what I think?
Go ahead, Shane.
You know what I think? You know what I think really hurts a guy like Kevin White, too? And Phil, you can speak to this because we talked about it. You know, he goes out there and is training, you know, for the NFL Combine, and then he goes out there and pops that 4.35. Looking back at Kevin White at West Virginia, Phil, he was never a 4.35 guy on tape watching him. He was never a speed merchant wide receiver. He played with that, like, and Azani talked about that. He played with that physical nature where he went up and he got the ball and you know, he did have the ability to pull away from guys, but he had a lot of contested catches, you know, at West Virginia. And he's just got to get back to that, and it's part of it. When you break your bones in your leg two separate times, you know, you got to have confidence in that. You have the pressure of living up to the hype of a number seven pick. You have three wide receiver coaches in 3 years. We knew he was a raw wide receiver coming in. And it's just a recipe for a confidence issue. But it's not going to matter if Azani keeps him away from the papers. It's not going to, you know, matter. This is all on Kevin White. Kevin White's got to learn the playbook. He's got to be prepared that way, and he's got to be prepared to go out there and make plays, because none of this is going to change until he can get out there and prove that. If he goes out there and gets hurt again or looks pedestrian, it's going to be a lot of the same old Kevin White that we've seen so far, and he's never going to live up to that hype of number seven overall. But to me, it's just a, you know, you want to see the kid go out there and at least, really, to me, if he has one big game, I think that momentum, because looking back, even in that Dallas game last year when he made that one catch down the sideline, he got up and he got hyped and he was
pounding important.
His chest. Yeah, that,
you're talking you're talking about his training for the combine speed versus tape speed. Shane, when I watched this tape on this football player, he was my number two receiver in that draft, behind Amari Cooper, obviously. I had Amari way higher than him. However, first-round receiver in my mind because he was fluid. He could catch the football. He can high point. He gives you a big target. He wasn't afraid to go up and grab stuff. He also would track the ball over the top very well. He showed athleticism in the route tree. He showed, you know, there wasn't much route being done, so I couldn't negatively assess him for that. It was the playbook at West Virginia, but when he got a screen pass or he got a deep in, he's catching the ball with hands and he's running well after the catch. He's a step ahead. The injuries start to make him second guess. Now he's not as confident. He's not having as much fun doing it. That's where it's got to be. And my other point to this kid, you know, is if he doesn't know his playbook now, then he shouldn't even be on this roster. Because you've sat for 3 years, you've had nothing but time as a professional athlete to absolutely know the ins, every inch of that playbook he should know. He should be a coach on the football field right now. If he cannot be that, then I'm sorry. That's just me being honest that it's not acceptable. And this fan base and this team just pushing guys out there because of where they were drafted, and not holding them accountable as professional athletes that are helping or hurting their quarterback, whether it be Glennon or Trubisky or Sanders, whoever's in there, they have a responsibility to know it. And Kevin White, for 3 years, has been out. You've had all this offseason. He better know his play. That should be the last. And the only reason why I'm bringing that up, Aldo, is because all the other stuff comes next. If you know your plays, you can go full speed, and you could just be you. And that's where I think the coach was trying to put pressure on him. I agree with Shane. But if he doesn't go out there and have fun and be him, then ultimately he doesn't belong here on this run. If he doesn't know his play and he's messing up, throwing picks because he's supposed to run a deep out, he ran a post, Glennon throws the deep out, and they just sit there and pick, oh, Glennon sucks. We've seen this before. It just destroys the whole team. Can't have that on the football field, and that's where the coaches have to be, you know, accountable as well when it comes to this guy.
Now, Aldo, you mentioned you listened to that interview with Zaidman on the Bears Access. Mm-hmm. Maybe you even have the audio of it. Glennon specifically talks about how high Kevin White's confidence is, and they've told him the huge difference in his confidence from last season to where he is at right now. Mike Glennon specifically talked about that in that interview with Zaidman, because I listened to it today too. So I you know, it kind of flies in the face of what Azani was saying. That's why I think he's just trying to call him out and saying, you know, this is your chance, Kevin. You gotta do this and fuck the newspapers and all that, and the, you know, negative Twitter and all. Just go out there, play the way that we know that you can play. We think you're a great player. We drafted you 7th overall. We obviously believe that. Go out there, play football. That's what you're good at. That's what you need to do. Don't worry about the ancillary bullshit.
Let me go to Lauren and ask him, based on what he has seen from camp, what are your expectations regarding the Chicago Bears depth chart? That relates to a question from our buddy Rafael Tucker, who has asked, what's the projected wide receiver depth chart based on camp observations, and how legit is Gentry? By the way, Tucker, when he watches Bears games, he's drinking Redemption Rye Bourbon. This dude is serious. He's a serious Bears fan.
Sign me up. Really? I'm a bourbon guy.
Oh, really? Yeah, that. Oh, yeah. I'm definitely putting that on the list next time I go to the liquor store. All right.
Raise the Modelo. There you go. The
Lauren, tell us your depth chart.
You know, the thing that really complicates the depth chart is Marcus Wheaton's appendectomy,
mm-hmm.
because I think they originally envisioned him as the slot guy with Cameron Meredith and Kevin White. You know, with all three of them having the ability to be deep ball receivers, I think they really were envisioning that sort of combination with them. And then, you know, a Deion Sims, Adam Shaheen on the inside that can work over the middle and sort of take advantage of those three receivers on with their speed and their long ball ability to take the top off. And I know Cameron Meredith can work all over the field, but White and Wheaton are both very vertical receivers more than lateral receivers. So I was really curious to see where Wheaton was supposed to fit in there. But for now, right, you're seeing, you know, still White, Meredith as the starters. And when I was there, Josh Bellamy and Deontay Thompson were sort of the 3 and 4 in terms of the snap rotation and in drills. You know, Meredith and White would go first. The next two receivers up were Thompson, Bellamy, which is concerning and surprising, but I just don't know how long that's going to last, given the talent that you have with Kendall Wright and Victor Cruz, both of whom I think are looking impressive for, you know, based on what we knew and were sort of expecting from a couple of guys that are older now. I know Wright's still under 30, so he's not old, but they aren't the guys that they once were. They've long removed from their 1,000-yard seasons. I thought Victor Cruz looked particularly quick, and, you know, not a long-speed guy anymore, but definitely has very quick feet and can change direction very quickly. And Kendall Wright, I think, had the slight step ahead of him when I was there on Sunday in terms of who was getting more opportunities with the first team. And then sort of behind them, I wanted to see more Daniel Braverman, and I didn't. He worked in some with the second team, but mostly third team. Wanted to see more Reuben Randall, too. But Tanner Gentry, like Raphael asked about, he made some really nice catches working with Mitch Trubisky, but again, it was all third team, and it wasn't as though he's playing against nobody in coverage. I mean, I don't want to take away from the plays he was able to make, because ultimately it's up to him to make the most of the opportunities that he's given. But it's one thing to see highlight videos on Twitter that I tweeted out, Gentry making some nice catches, and equate that to him necessarily dominating every rep at camp. He's made some nice catches, but it's not as though he is playing like a number one receiver or anything like that. I think he's only making more room for himself and is doing a lot of great things for his chances on this roster, but it's not as though after 5-6 days of practice, whatever it's been now, he's all of a sudden earned a roster spot. I think he's still on the outside looking in and likely is going to be a practice squad candidate at best, just because of the combination of special teams talent that they have in Bellamy and Thompson and offensive talent that they have with Cruz, Wright, and Wheaton. I don't think Gentry is better than any of those three guys on offense or those two guys on special teams in either of those areas, and ultimately they can get away with stashing him on the practice squad. So I'm not anticipating him sticking on that 53, but I think it's going to come down to maybe one of Cruz or Wright, and depending on what happens with Wheaton and the long-term prognosis there. Like, if he were to start the year on the PUP, then maybe you keep Wright and Cruz, but at this point, I'm not sure if they can keep both of those guys if they're not contributing significantly on special teams. And Deontay Thompson and Josh Bellamy offer you so much more there, and the team clearly seems to like them on offense for some reason. They continue to get those opportunities. So I'm bracing for both Thompson and Bellamy on the final roster, maybe taking the place of a Victor Cruz or a Kendall Wright or a Daniel Braverman that could potentially offer you more on offense.
It's quite a deep group, and there's going to be lots of interesting decisions to come. I want to get to some of these other questions because we've got quite a few of them. I'll send this one to Shane. Champ is already looking at a losing season and asking who's going to be coaching the Bears next season. Is it going to be Stoops or Gruden? What do you think, Shane?
Oh, I hope neither.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I'm never been a big fan of Bob Stoops, and I think there's a lot of... I used to be more of a Gruden fan than I am now. I think, you know, I think there's a lot of hype there. You know, John Gruden, I think a lot of him, he gets hyped up having the, you know, the John Gruden quarterback camp and stuff like that. But if I'll sit here and wait and have somebody tell me how many young quarterbacks that John Gruden has groomed in his career that he's won with, it's a non-existent list. He's a veteran quarterback guy, so I think that gets hyped up a little bit too much. But Aldo, you and I had a little talk, and everybody sorry. Okay over there?
That was the dog over here having a bad dream in her crate, thinking about the next days of coaching. I guess
I was saying, don't talk about Steph like that.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned Bob Stoops, and even the dogs go crazy.
Yeah, really.
But Dan Durkin actually brought up an interesting name that Ryan Pace has. He said that Ryan Pace is pretty high on a guy like Jim Bob Cooter. You see him working with Matthew Stafford up in Detroit, and he's a young quarterback, slash guru, offensive coordinator now in Detroit. I think he's only 33 years old, so I think that's a potential candidate that I may keep my eyes on moving forward into the offseason.
Yeah, there's no doubt that this guy's going to be an NFL head coach. He has the leadership skills, despite the fact that you got busted for getting drunk one day and waking up in somebody's bed. That was a few years ago, but he's clearly very well liked by his fellow football coaches, football players. Matt Stafford has responded really well, and I think an indication of how good of a coach this guy is. He reminds me, Shane and I talked about this, he reminds me a lot of Adam Gase, in that he knows how to protect the quarterback. And if you look at Stafford's performance last year, he was sacked much less than he had been in previous years, where the previous offensive coordinator, I think it was Lombardi's cousin, just didn't give a shit about protecting his quarterback. And as soon as Cooter took over, the quarterback sacks dropped. Completion percentage went up really high. This guy knows how to coach, and yeah, he would make an interesting coaching candidate. All right,
we encourage getting drunk and waking up in other people's homes. I mean, that's why we brought Jose Cotto on board.
That's right.
So have at it.
That's right, and that's a tease for our audience. We've got some Jose Cotto sound coming up in a little while. I'm editing that and putting it into the tail end of the show. I want to ask this question to both Shane and Phil, who have kids. Randy asked about the CTE issue that is plaguing the NFL. There was a recent study that there was something like 119 out of 121 brains that were looked at by Boston University all showed signs of CTE. Now, clearly, you know, these brains were looked at because there were symptoms already associated with these people who donated their brains for science. But nonetheless, it still is a serious issue. And so Randy wants to know, will you guys let your kids play football? And then I'll ask Lauren, the last part of this is, how long do you think that football is going to be around if the CTE issue continues? So, Phil, you've got some little ones. Are you going to let them play pro football, or, excuse me, tackle football?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you why, because I think that it's the ultimate team sport, and young men just learn how to be better men once they've played this great game. I think it just teaches compassion and teamwork and togetherness, life lessons that people have for a lifetime. I mean, I coached for 11 years. I still have players that'll come up to me and regret the day they decided to quit football after the season, and looking back, wishing they had stayed and continued to play. But the lessons they learned as a freshman football player were lifelong lessons, and they share these. I mean, if it didn't happen more than 20 times, I wouldn't even be sharing that. But, you know, it's just such a great experience, and it's a great game. So I just would never cheat my sons out of the opportunity to do that. with the CTE issues. I had 13 concussions throughout my life, Aldo. 14th.
That answers a lot.
The 14th was the one that pushed me over the top. So if I'm living with CTE, you know, I'd still go back and play that game of football. I can't express how much it taught me as a father and as a friend and about loyalty and teamwork. So I think I would never bar them or force them to play. I would not hinder them from the opportunity to play this great game.
How many concussions?
13.
Shane, what about you? You got how old is your son? 9 or 10?
No, he's 6.
Oh man, he looks like 9 or 10.
Yeah.
He's 12, he's Shane, 14.
Yeah.
He's a big young man.
I know where you live, Lauren.
Are you going to let him play football?
You know, Phil really put it perfectly. Probably a lot of people are, maybe nobody really cares, but I've never played a snap of organized football in my life. Growing up, I played soccer, basketball, and baseball. And currently, my son is involved in all three of those sports almost on a daily basis in different leagues throughout the summer and spring and winter of the school year. But I'm never going to – if my son comes up and wants to play football, Phil put it perfectly, I'm not going to prevent him from playing football if that's what he wants to do. He can play. I'm not gonna be one of those fathers that says, no, you're gonna concentrate on, you're 6 years old, you're gonna, you know, concentrate on football, and that's what you're gonna do for the rest of your life. It's that you don't get anywhere in that. And I think you hear around the NFL draft, you hear a lot of these guys that are getting drafted into the NFL, you know, they're multi-sport kids growing up, and I think that's really important. And I don't think it's just football that teaches you how to be a good man and teaches you about teamwork. I think there's a lot of different sports that can do that. But if my son Riley comes up to me and says, Dad, I want to play football, I'm going to support him 100%. If he never walks up to me and brings up football, I'm not going to try to push him in that direction. I do want to push him into sports and have him active that way, but I'm not going to direct him one way or the other. It's really going to come down to what he prefers. But, you know, at the same time, this CTE stuff is scary. You know, you hear Phil say it right there, 13 concussions, and then the 14th one, you know, kind of ended his playing career. And unfortunately, I do think down the line there's going to be a lot more to this. It just seems like it's just, you know, the tip of the iceberg with all of this. And it's, unfortunately, I don't think it's going away anytime soon. And it is a scary deal. But back to my son, I want him involved in sports, but I'm not going to drive him to play football just because I'm a football fan myself, especially.
Lauren, you attend University of Wisconsin. There was a player there named Chris Borland, a linebacker who had an excellent career there. Played his rookie season with the Raiders, and he retired. And the reason he cited for his retirement was his concerns about the head injuries he suffered playing college and football, and even going back to when he played peewee football. So what are your thoughts about this whole CTE issue? Do you think that it's going to endanger the future of pro football?
Well, for the record, Chris Borland played for the San Francisco 49ers, not the Oakland Raiders.
My bad.
But I don't know. I don't think it's going to take down football or anything. I don't think it's going to doom the end of the National Football League. But I do think you're going to see more players trend in sort of the Chris Borland direction as they become more educated about CTE. I think It's never going to die, and it's never going to, well, I don't say never, but this isn't going to make it die, and it isn't going to decline it in such a horrible rate that it shrivels up to the to a shadow of what it once was. But I do think that it's going to become a time where like players are fully informed and then consent to playing football in spite of a well understood knowledge of the potential physical harm that they can face from doing it. And I think as players learn more about that and have to make a consensual choice to do so, you're going to see more of them opt not to do it professionally and perhaps not even collegiately in some cases. But I don't think it's ever going to decline to a certain extent. But I think they're also a long way from even getting to that point, because I don't remember who it was, but some team's rookie defensive back. It wasn't like Malik Hooker or Garion Conley, but it was, I don't know why the Ohio State guys are coming to mind, but some team's rookie was asked about this and was asked about CTE and the recent study. And his answer was something like,
Was it Jamal Adams?
There's no place, yes, I'd rather die than on a football field. And so that was the clear sign to me that he has no idea what CTE is or what he's getting into, because he thinks it's something that would happen to him dying on the football field. So it's going to be a long way before players across the board consistently understand what playing football does to them. And that's when you'll see them start to have more of an exodus from playing the sport. But it's going to take a long time for that to truly have an informed player base to make those decisions. And like I said, even once there is an informed base of players, you're still going to see the majority of them continue to play football knowing the potential harm that they will face.
It takes a special breed of athlete to play the game of football. It takes a daredevil with excellent athletic abilities. And I think that they're one of the reasons we watch pro football and love pro football is not only the ballet aspect of it, the beauty of the game and Lynn Swann going up and making that tremendous catch, but it's also the brutality, the seeing people literally put their lives on the line to play this game. So the question is with football undergoing many rule changes to protect players from head injuries, is that collision going to be minimized as the years go on, and are we going to see a watered-down version of football? I think there's a very good chance of that, but at the same time, to Lauren's point, there's always going to be a breed of athlete who is going to want to knock heads with somebody else. You see it in You see it in boxing. You see it with auto racers who put their lives on the line, you know, driving vehicles made out of fiberglass going 220 miles an hour around a turn. And you see those terrible crashes and so forth. On and on, there's a level of sports that the danger in it is not only what attracts fans, but also what attracts athletes.
And for the record, Aldo, I played in the late 80s, early 90s, well, middle 90s, 95.
Basically late 80s.
95 was my last year. That was my college. That was my last injury. For the record, I played in a time where the coaches and players, oh, you got your bell rung, get back in there. And that's how the whole, what's the word I'm looking for? The expectation of every player was, you get your bell rung, you get back in there and you get after it. And that time, nowadays, if there's a hesitation in a player getting up from a severe collision, then that player is being examined by a neurologist. So there, I mean, the practices, we did double sessions in the dead of summer. And that's for the young fucks out there like Lauren. That's morning, 8 o'clock circuit, then full pad practice after that circuit. Then an afternoon after lunch, another full practice again. So really three, there's a conditioning aspect. Then there was an absolute full-on practice from 10 in the morning till noon. Then 12 to 2, you had a break. And then 2 o'clock, you're back on the practice field till 5 with another three-hour full practice. That was, everybody was, that's how it was. Now, there's all these rules. They can't even hit in practice. So to the point, Aldo, is football going to be around? I think there's a lot of money in football, and money talks, and there's no way football is going away. I laugh when I see that. It's the most popular sport in the country, if not the world. You know, it's something that I just can never see. And I think the technology is just continuing to grow. You're seeing virtual reality used with your rookie quarterback right now in Chicago. I just believe that the technology with the helmet and the protection and the limiting of contact, although I don't think it helps the sport as a whole, come Sundays, you see sloppy tackling because they're not doing it. I do think it's helping to limit the amount of concussion.
All right, we are well over an hour, and we still have so much to talk about. And I want to play some tape of Jose's pre-show appearance, some funny stuff that I want to share with you guys. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go to one last question because I teased it at the beginning of the show. I said that we were going to touch on tight ends, and George writes this question, and he believes that the Bears should keep four tight ends, Shaheen, Miller, Sims, and Brown. And do we agree? Let's go around the table and get our just some general thoughts about the tight end position, which has really been one of the big topics of camp so far. Shane, what are your thoughts about the Bears' tight end position?
You know, we went over it a little bit, and Phil really hit it out of the park when he brought it up a couple of shows ago, especially when you're talking about this quarterback situation that we have here in Chicago. And I think it's kind of playing out with what you're seeing with Mike Glennon, being that, you know, he's got the arm strength to go downfield, but he's showing, you know, a lot of these intermediate throws, and you got a young guy like Mitch Trubisky that doesn't have a lot of experience. But I really think the safe bet is to carry the four tight ends. I mean, if you know that that's a strength, I don't really know why you would take away from that. The biggest question to me is, are you willing to risk losing a guy like a Ben Broniker, who does have practice squad eligibility, or Mycole Pruitt, who I believe still has practice squad eligibility, for a guy like Zach Miller, who's proven to be a fantastic player, but he's also proven to be injured year after year. You know, I can't really put it any other way than I just, you know, I think they're going to go safe, carry that fourth tight end, because really, to me, when you're talking about the future of the Chicago Bears, I mean, Deion Sims has the contract, has the guaranteed money that says that he's going to be here. Adam Shaheen, they invested in the second round. And again, to point back to that interview, Aldo, that you listened to with Zach Zaidman and Mike Glennon, Mike Glennon brought up himself that he was really excited about Daniel Brown. Mm-hmm. And he's that guy that I don't think a lot of people are talking about, that really showed that he's got a lot of the prerequisite skills that could make him really a diamond in the rough for this team moving forward. So to me, I would err on the side of caution, carry that fourth tight end. But then to me, it's do you want to risk losing a Broniker or a Mycole Pruitt on the practice squad to keep the elder statesman like Zach Miller, who's, like I said, a fine player, but he's that injury history is it's an extensive one. Let's be honest.
Phil, up in your neck of the woods, you see a lot of New England Patriots football, and they run a lot of three tight end sets. How excited are you about seeing these Bears tight ends in a tight end set, in a three tight end set?
We talked about it on Bears Hour Live. I talked about it here. I looked on paper, and I said I thought that was the most talented position on this team, on this roster, the most depth. I was very excited, to be perfectly honest, about the prospects. I think Shane really hit it on the head there in regards to the number I want to see. I think there's no other way. I think you're absolutely keeping four tight ends. Which four they are, I'm going to disagree with a little bit with Shane, but I'm going to answer your question when you look at the New England Patriots, you obviously see an attacking everywhere on the football field used offense. So they can hit you with their slot play. That opens up their tight end play. Then they could take shots downfield. The copycat league, you saw an emphasis on the slot position. You also obviously are seeing an emphasis on the tight end position, getting athletic guys that are going to be able to help young quarterbacks, their best friend or a tight end, as well as guys that haven't played in a while, to get that feel and get that intermediate consistency there. I think Ryan Pace did an excellent job assembling talent at that position. However, I'm going to disagree with Shane, and I think if I'm the coach, just now, we haven't even seen the games, but today we're talking, I'm looking at this roster, and I see Deion Sims as my starting tight end, and then I see young Adam Shaheen as my move tight end, interchangeable with Zach Miller. Now I'm going to use Zach Miller's, his fragile, how would I say this, fragility? What is the word I'm looking for? The fact that he's constantly injured, I'm going to use him as a chess piece to create mismatches, as a wing tight end, a motion tight end, and put him in the slot where he played an awful lot. I think Lauren Cox talked about it on Bears Hour Live. At 47% ratio of their offense, he was in the slot. That's Zach Miller. So I'm going to use that guy's ability, but not as an every down starter. So now you've upgraded where you're bringing in Logan Paulson, of all people, as your third tight end. Now I'm going to use Zach Miller as that person, and I'm going to have that competition between the three of those players, one which all of us were talking about throughout the season, let alone the offseason, how impressed we were with Daniel Brown. I just don't think you can lose that kind of football player. And the fact that he's similar to Zach Miller gives you a security blanket where I think you can be safe in putting a Broniker or a Michael Pruitt on the practice squad or pulling one of them back. And I just think that your goal should be to move the chains. And if Zach Miller is practicing well and he's healthy, then I think you use him smartly. He's not your starter. He's your game day chess piece. And that's how I'd use that football player. But I think in the similar fashion as the New England Patriots, you get isolated plays and down and distance, and you use those talented athletes. I think Shaheen is somebody who's showcasing great, tremendous hands. You know, he's still going to be a work in progress in his route tree and what he's going to do, but the athleticism there, and if you have a hands catcher that's 6'7", 278 pounds, almost 280, or whatever he is, I know Lauren got to see him there live and how big he is and compared to other people. You can talk about that, Lauren, but to me, just his size alone and his speed, coupled with the fact that he can catch the football, as I'm being told by more than one person, just snatch grabbing it, I think you're getting a real talented positional group there in Chicago, and I think you'd be foolish to let go of a Zach Miller at this point, because he can give you that chess piece with a Daniel Brown, with a Shaheen and a Deion Sims. They can interchange as well as Brown and Miller, and that right there is going to, you know, push this offense further than people are expecting.
Lauren, you want to offer up a thought about the tight ends before we close?
Yeah, to start, if I'm going to be that guy, I don't think the New England Patriots were ever a three tight end team last year, just because Rob Gronkowski was hurt. Yeah. They almost never went full three tight end. They did a lot. They did more two tight end, I think, than some pretty much anybody else in the league. But to be the stickler, the Patriots were not a three tight end offense much at all.
Thank you, you asshole.
It was the Atlanta Falcons that were the real three tight end offense. But the Kyle Shanahan and company, I think we're going to see that in San Francisco this year too. And I would definitely be 100% on board with that in Chicago. I'm not sure about this four tight end thing. I keep going back and forth on it. I think tight end and safety are the two positions that are the most difficult to cut down here, and they might be forced to keep four tight ends. But at what point are you overloading on tight ends and backfield players here when you look at, you know, the number of running backs that they might want to keep? They kept four at the start of the regular season last year. And you got the fullback in there, too, that is like another tight end. You know, does that give you essentially five tight end-type players if you're keeping Michael Burton? I just don't know where, you know, like, I feel like I would keep, you know, if you were 100% confident in Ben Broniker, he's your fullback slash tight end, your move, you know, your backfield move tight end, and you keep him over a Mike Burton, and then I can live with four tight ends because you don't have a fullback on top of that. But if you want to keep four running backs and four tight ends and a fullback, that's almost a fifth of your roster just on running backs and fullbacks. And then, you know, you're then sacrificing the depth at potentially wide receiver, at linebacker, at cornerback, at safety, you know, elsewhere on your team. When, you know, are four tight ends really going to be used effectively by this offensive coordinator? I mean, we saw last year, they actually started the regular season with just two tight ends, Zach Miller and Logan Paulson, and Paul Asike wasn't even there. So it was really two tight ends, no fullbacks, and four running backs. They, you know, they seemed to put the emphasis in the backfield. But then they went and eventually added Ben Broniker off the practice squad, added Paul Asike off the practice squad, and then later added Daniel Brown off of waivers from the Baltimore Ravens, a team who sure could use Daniel Brown right now with all their tight end injuries, and definitely a Zach Miller trade target, in my opinion, the Baltimore Ravens. If I'm Ryan Pace, I'm flashing that at them all day, all night, ringing up Ozzie Newsome to get a fifth or a sixth round pick for Zach Miller, and then just roll with Sims, Shaheen, and Daniel Brown. I'm not that concerned about losing a Ben Broniker, and especially not a Michael Pruitt to other teams. Broniker maybe, but Pruitt has bounced around so much, I don't feel like there's 10 teams lining up to try and get him on the roster. Not that he wouldn't have interest from other teams, but he's a guy that, you know, at this point, you know, there's still something in the tank and you want to see if you can get it out of him, but it's not as though he is the true diamond in the rough that a Daniel Brown might be and that a Ben Broniker might be. So I'm not as concerned about losing Pruitt. I like what Pruitt offers, but he hasn't put it all together yet, and I don't know. I guess I don't know what points to him putting it all together all of a sudden this year. Not that there's no chance of it, just I'm not counting on Michael Pruitt. So I think all the talk about Brown is real, and I think he's almost, to me, he's close to a lock on this roster just with the way, even before the preseason and the training camp started, the way he's been talked about. I think it really is he, Sims, and Shaheen, and then maybe Zach Miller. But I just don't, you don't often see, or Dowell Loggins doesn't seem like a guy to me that learns that well and is going to just all of a sudden flip his offense completely. I mean, I don't know that, I mean, you know, is he going to become such a tight end focused offense now? And really, has he been a guy that proves he knows how to put his offensive players in the best position to be successful and to identify the best offensive players for his team and to then utilize those best offensive players in the way that is most effective for them? I mean, we did not see that last year, and so I'm not 100% confident in him seeing the proper role for Sims, Miller, Shaheen, and Brown all in the offense at the same time, especially when you have these three veteran slot receivers that they signed. You have a returning Kevin White that they're going to try and force the ball to as a starter, and then you have Cameron Meredith, who we all love, and I'm expecting huge things from him. I just don't have confidence in this offensive coaching staff just yet to figure out exactly how to best utilize these tight ends. So I think, you know, they'll probably stick with three and maybe keep Miller as a four. But I do think they're going to try and trade Miller because I don't remember who it was, but some semi-mainstream reporter podcasted that the Bears were waving Zach Miller on the trade block back at the combine. They were just shopping him to other teams before they had even signed Deion Sims and before they had even signed is the combine before free agency? I don't remember, but before they had drafted
remember that well too.
So clearly the writing is being 100% on the wall for Zach Miller. I really don't think they want him here. And I feel the same way about Kyle Fuller, that those guys are both working with the full team, the first team, and they're going to work with the first team in the preseason so that other teams will see them perform and see that they're healthy and see that they're still talented players so they can dump them off for a trade.
Well, I don't want to be that guy either, Lauren. But Mecole Pruitt was drafted in 2015 and only bounced around with the team that he was drafted, Minnesota Vikings, and then was signed by the Bears after two seasons in the NFL.
Well, regardless, a cast off.
Okay, I just wanted to get you back. All right.
You can only get coverage like that from Locked On Bears.
Okay, when we opened the show, I promised you that we'd insult a good portion of our listeners, and we really didn't. We were fairly well behaved for most of the show. But don't
I blasted Lambert. I blasted Lambert again.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. But don't I know you're expecting more, and you're in luck, because before we opened the show, the four of us had a chance to talk to Jose Cotto, who's in some sort of witness protection program. And after the music bridge, you'll hear some truly offensive stuff that Jose has shared with us, so you might want to lower the volume in case your mom walks into the room. Unless your mom is interested in lessons on how to lick ass, then you can just play full blast. And remember, please tell your friends about the show, and if you drink, don't drive, and always bear down. Brother Jose, it's been a long time. How are you?
Well, I'm very fine. Thank you for asking.
Now, you and the guys recently exchanged some text messages where you expressed an affinity for, dumpster diving?
What?
Licking the spokes.
Okay.
Eating ass.
Oh, of course.
You said it started at camp when you were younger.
Well, how could I resist? I mean, a Latino youth summer camp where all you eat is tacos and cheese.
And you said the trick is to go in there and get it done quickly?
Oh, I am very fast. What's this?
Thanks, Jose. Hope to have you back on the show real soon.